Hello, and welcome to another episode of Public Theologians, where Christian theology animates leftist political action. I'm Casey Hobbs. Glad you're joining. Today is going to be a conversation with Dr. Catherine Jin Lum. She is the author of Damned Nation, Hell in America from the Revolution to Reconstruction. She is Associate Professor of Religious Studies in collaboration with the Center for Comparative Studies in Race and Ethnicity and of History by Courtesy at Stanford University. She is also the author of a forthcoming book on Harvard University Press called Heathen, Religion and Race in American History. This is a phenomenal read. It's coming out in middle of May. I'm, of course, going to put a link to pre-order the book in the show notes. The conversation is wide and ranging, and to me, it was enjoyable. I think it'll be enjoyable to you as well. So one quick plug, you can give us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. That will be so appreciated. Get a little boost in the visibility for this and other conversations on Public Theologians. Now, thanks for listening, and here's my conversation with Dr. Catherine Jin Lum. Dr. Catherine Jin Lum, thank you so much for joining me on Public Theologians.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah. So first of all, congratulations on your book coming out, Heathen, Religion and Race in American History, that will be coming out at the middle of May this year. Can you tell us a little bit about the book's origins and what got you started on this project?
Yeah. So, okay. So this is a book about the figure of the heathen in the American imagination. And the origins of the book are both, I guess, personal and academic. So on the personal front, I was raised in a pretty conservative Christian tradition. I was raised to basically believe that much of the world was heathen and that it was, my responsibility, the responsibility of people in my church to go out and save those people who were heathen. But on the other hand, I am also I'm of Chinese descent. And so I am of the people who have been considered to be heathen. And so, sure. So as a kid, I always kind of wondered about that and wondered about how I could be both like the us and the them. I write about this a bit in the book. And I wondered about my ancestors, about relatives, about people in China who were supposedly damned. And for me, it was kind of this weird feeling of being, thinking that I was lucky to be born in America, or maybe not lucky. That wasn't the right word. It was blessed, right? It was never
sure,
luck.
Sure.
blessed to be born in America. Like, what did I do to deserve that? And I grew up thinking like I hadn't done anything. So how is this fair? So I went into the study of religion to try to kind of work through some of these questions, work through some of these problems. And on the academic front, so my first book is actually about hell in America, about the concept of damnation. And so I guess you could say I've been working through these questions for a long time, like just sure. trying to wonder, to ask, like, how is it fair that the vast majority of the world could be damned and then some people could be saved, and it's the responsibility of the people who are saved to save those who are supposedly damned. That's really kind of the genesis of the book. And these are questions that I am still working through, thinking through them as a historian, but still trying to figure out kind of for myself personally.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. And I saw that you had previously written a book on hell. And so I was, it's funny how some of the writing that we do and the research, especially that y'all do as academics, kind of is a lot of, like you said, it's a lot of personal work, I think, a lot of times.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah. So you start off with the etymology of the word itself, and you go all the way back to at least the beginnings of the Christian religion. You hit on Augustine, you hit on kind of those early church fathers and their views, particularly of the us and them. So give us just a little history of the word itself, heathen, and those kind of attending terms that go along with it.
So the term heathen is a kind of Germanic translation of the Latin pagan, which refers to those country dwellers, essentially, who did not embrace the new religion of Christianity, but clung to the old gods of Rome, right? So the heathen were similarly thought to be those people who lived in the heath, who lived in the wildernesses away from the centers of, you know, quote unquote civilization, who clung to old gods like Thor and Odin, and rejected Christianity. So yeah, the book is, it's pretty wide ranging in that it looks at, Christian debates over, you know, these questions about the fairness of heathen salvation or damnation have been asked for centuries. And so the book kind of looks at those debates. It does focus primarily on the American context, but the American context is, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. And that's,
sure.
that's one of the points that I try to make in the book, that a lot of this is just, you know, repeating the same history over and over and over again.
Yeah. And to that point, throughout the book, and this is really great, involved work. So we're not going to even hardly skim the surface of it in our time. But you take this long ranging view, again, like you said, of American history in particular. And as I was reading, I was just thinking through the highly racialized themes, and historically who has been the them in American right. cultural history. And so I'm curious, just how, I guess, how the religious context of a nominally Christian nation as we were founded, and obviously that's completely fraught and oversimplified, yeah, but right. but in name, you know, there was a lot more Christian, at least cultural significance yeah. with the founding fathers than anyone else. But yeah, as immigration started and really in kind of full force, and as Chinese immigrants came here and kind of the same vein, and you can speak more to this, I'm sure, but as the Irish, when they came over, and they're just mm-hmm. the highly racialized thought about what it meant to be white, whether as opposed to these other heathens. So particular to kind of the religious experience and the religious perspectives of those early immigrants, just talk about how even in a religious sense, that racialized construct was alive and well and yeah. furthered with a religious bent. If that's
yeah.
a useful yeah, yeah. question.
Yeah, that's no, that's a great question. I think one of the really interesting things, actually, to connect first back to your previous question, one of the interesting things about this history of the development of the concept of heathen is that it goes from, you know, the heathens are like basically Europeans, right? The pagans are Romans who've rejected sure. Christianity. They're first Europeans who've rejected Christianity.
Yeah, you're talking about and Thor then, and yeah.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Western. And then once like Europeans come to realize that like, oh wait, we're not the only people on this planet, right? Then the category becomes both a really useful one for them, right? To try to like fit all of these other people into this framework, but also a really kind of challenging one. Because the framework or the concept of the heathen then has to become like really expansive. Like mm-hmm. how does this one category come to incorporate so many different kinds of people? And so that's one of the questions that I try to examine in the book with the rise of racial science. You know, racial science tries to hierarchize, right? It tries to divide and subdivide and classify people. But the category of heathen is like much more of a blunt instrument. Like it's sure. much more of this, you know, broad based umbrella. Exactly. It's like, nope, everybody falls under this category of heathen, right? So like, how do those two things align? And so, yeah, so I look at this problem by referring to what I call the replacement narrative. So historically, a number of scholars have treated the concept of the heathen as like basically categorically different from race, different from racial othering. So they've said that heathenness is this religious way of othering that divides the world into an us versus them based on religious belief. And it's not racial because it's not understood to be innate, right? So you're supposed to be able to convert away from heathenism. And like, that is that's the impetus for missionary movements, right? Is to go out and convert the rest of the world. And they've said that, well, if you can convert away from heathenism, then that's not race, it's not racial, because race is a quality that is innate you know, biological scientific racism holds people to be different because of things that they cannot change, right? So most predominantly the color of their skin. But I'm really inspired by scholarship that has argued for understanding race in a more kind of expansive way that understands race as a project of colonial governance. So here I want to just cite Sylvester Johnson and Barner Hess in particular, who've argued for this way of understanding race. So if you understand race as a project of governance, colonial governance, it's a way of dividing the world into those who are the governors and those who are the governed. And here I think that the concept of the heathen is like super important, right? And it doesn't just go away with the rise of scientific racism. I think it underlies it. I'm not trying to argue against the fact that like, yeah, scientific racism is super important. This like hierarchical division of the world is very important. But at the same time, I also don't want us to lose sight of this kind of binary othering and the way in which the idea that like much of the world needs to be changed is itself a racial racist project. Like, the very idea that people need to be changed and there are people who can change them justifies all sorts of things. So from colonial interventions, you know, enslavement, the rise of residential schools, all sorts of things can be justified under this framework of they need to be changed.
Yeah. I was thinking as you're saying that also just about terminology. I mean, to throw one more thing in there is class. When you talk about how when you even in framing and talking about why people came here in the first place, I mean, there's an element of them serving capital, and that's the entire, like seeing that as the entire point of the stratifications and the divisions, I think it has obviously a lot of overlap with the term colonialism. And I'm interested to get into your thoughts later in the book on Franz Fanon, a little bit later in the conversation.
Yeah, sure.
You talked about residential schools and you know, the history particular to the way that white folks treated Native Americans here, but also Hawaii. You talked quite a bit about Hawaii, and I was thinking that was particularly interesting. Just a month ago, in early March, the U.S. Navy shut down the Red Hill fuel station in Oahu that had been open since 1943. I wanted to just kind of in context of what you had written about Hawaii, I wanted to maybe read like a little bit of Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, his framing of this. I thought was really
cool.
Curious in light of your work. So he says, and Red Hill has served our armed forces well for many decades, but it makes a lot less sense now. The distributed and dynamic nature of our force posture in the Indo-Pacific, the sophisticated threats we face, the technology available to us demand an equally advanced and resilient fueling capacity, which is a lot of fun. And then later on in the statement, he says, nothing will be decided without careful consultation with our partners. The same goes for our workforce and their families. Your health has been impacted, your lives and livelihoods have been disrupted, and in many cases, your homes have been rendered unavailable to you. We owe you the very best healthcare we can provide, answers to your many questions, and clean, safe drinking water. Quite frankly, we owe you a return to normal, and you have my commitment to that end. As it relates, I guess, to like specific people that have been sent there on assignment, I suppose that is well and good. But yeah, you're talking about 80 years of destruction of particular to Red Hill. I mean, obviously, the history of Hawaii, you date that much further back in your history.
Right.
But I wanted to ask for you to kind of, yeah, connect your work on Hawaii to kind of this, again, he even brings up like now the threats are sophisticated, so we need to act in a different way. Even there's this kind of elitism posture that, again, completely ignores the devastating impacts to the natives of Hawaii, in which case many still don't accept our colonization of them. Mm-hmm.
So to try to like historically contextualize that that statement. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting, and the way that technology works into this like framing of who heathens are and who white American Christians are. White American Christians believe themselves, so this is something that really takes off in the 19th century with the creation of technologies like the railroad, telegraph, steam engines, you know, et cetera. They believe themselves to be God's chosen people who are favored by God, and that the manifestation of that favor comes through these technological developments. Mm. And they read this through an interpretation of the Bible, because they argue that heathens are, heathens can be classified. So there's a lot that goes into like the category of the heathen. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that heathens are said to do wrongly is that they have a misunderstanding of nature. Mm. So they have a misunderstanding of like the nature of God, but they have a misunderstanding of nature, because God in the Bible gives nature to man for his dominion, right? So like humans are supposed to domesticate the wild beasts, to domesticate the natural environment, et cetera. But heathens see, you know, they see spirits in nature. They don't want to disturb the bones of their ancestors, for instance, because they believe that their ancestors are still powerful beings. So, you know, various things like this. And so 19th century white American Christians say, because of this incorrect understanding of nature, the natural environment, and of God, heathens do not technologically advance. They're basically like stagnant. Mm. And so it's up to white Americans to bring technology to them. Technology enables white Americans to go to them more quickly. And then they bring technology to them to help them to cultivate their lands, right? So this is also like a real irony, sure, is that they're saying like, hey, we're, you know, bringing these technologies to help you. And then in many cases, these technologies end up, you know, as in that statement, mm-hmm, harming instead, right? In some cases, this happens very quickly. In Hawaii, this happens to the point where missionaries themselves are saying like, wait a minute, you know, the businessmen have like brought
too
in,
fast.
Yeah, it's too fast. Like this is not what we were talking about, mm-hmm, right? We were talking about like the introduction of small scale farming. We were not talking about like plantations coming here. And so they kind of actually bemoan some of these technological, mm-hmm, developments that they have supposedly brought to, you know, quote unquote, save the heathen. But they also, you know, they turn to the Bible to understand heathen landscapes as, mm, undeveloped, right? As like barren, as desert lands, even though like the evidence is obvious that they're not, mm-hmm, right? But in the book of Isaiah, right, they reference, I think it's Isaiah 34 and 35 repeatedly. You know, this is the verses where God demonstrates his anger against unbelieving inhabitants by turning the dust into brimstone, you know, the, mm, land into pitch, brings thorns into the palaces and things like this. And then it's when the glory of the Lord returns that the land blossoms again like the rose. And so these missionaries see themselves as bringing the glory of God to these, you know, quote unquote, heathen environments, bringing technologies that are supposed to enable the land to blossom as the rose. As we've seen, this is not often the case, right? Where it has serious, yeah, consequences that that are awful, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think that speaks a lot to the land. Talk a little bit about, we have at least one more shift, and then a couple more shifts, hopefully, in our conversation. But to kind of follow up and make this point as well, can you talk a little bit about the material impact that this classification had on folks? obviously the, you know, the verbiage is problematic. And like when we divide people, I mean, there's moral implications just to our own souls when we're choosing who can be a part of decent society and not. But yeah, I just want you to kind of talk for a minute on the real material impacts, particularly to the, you know, particularly to those that over time were just viewed as heathens, and classified as heathens. What particular blowback did they receive in that time, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, right. I think this is about so much more than just like the term itself, yeah. Right? It's about so much more than just like a mindset. And I think that maybe a helpful analogy or helpful way to think of it is to think about how scholars have talked about like racism, mm-hmm. for instance, right? So like racism is not just about like a personal individual belief that someone is inferior. Like a lot of people claim like, oh, I'm not a racist because I don't hold that belief. But it's about the system, right? The structures that kind of mindset has created. And I think similarly, and here's why I think like the concept of the heathen is, it is a religio-racial concept. It has racial ramifications. The concept of the heathen has like systemic and structural implications that have had a real bearing on the material outcomes or material livelihoods of people. So I mentioned before, like heathenism or the concept of the heathen was used to justify the enslavement of people of African descent, right? Obviously that's not like the only reason. I mean, when you spoke about capitalism, mm-hmm. like money, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, one could easily say like, well, really all of this comes down to money, mm-hmm. but the rationalizations, like that doesn't make them any less important, right?
Sure.
I don't think it's an either or.
Yeah.
Yeah, the idea that, you know, people of African descent are heathen, historically heathen, you know, there's pro-slavery Christian justifications of enslavement as the best way to teach people Christianity. Heathenism is used to justify, as I mentioned earlier, the residential school system. Like even today you have reporters who are saying, well, you know what, this is all worth it because salvation, like the grace of God was given to people who are in the residential schools. Like in the book, I talk about this as the, it's like a heathen get out of jail free ticket. Mm. Like when you, you know, when you call on this ticket, right, you're converting people in the name of heathens, that's used to excuse all manner of things. So the case of Hawaii, annexation of Hawaii, the supposed heathenism of the Hawaiian people was used to justify annexation, even though like by the late 19th century, many Hawaiians had converted to Christianity. Annexationists claim like, well, you know, they actually hadn't really converted, right? They maintain Hawaiian practices and therefore they cannot be trusted to govern themselves. Chinese exclusion is another case of like material repercussions, sure. of the concept of the heathen. By the late 19th century, the Chinese come to be seen as like the quintessential heathens. And that is used to justify their exclusion from the United States. There's this concern that Chinese heathens are going to bring heathenism here and basically like heathenize white Americans. Today.
The one doesn't sound like it's gone away at all.
Yeah.
Really, I mean. That's alive and well. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So we might not use the term heathen anymore, but there's all sorts of other terms that have come in the place of heathen, but that don't mean that the ideas that underlie it have gone away.
Yeah. Yeah. That whole just replacement fear, I think I really read any conservative, very conservative press. And I mean, yeah, the concern is that white people aren't, we're going to lose our place somehow at some right. point. And actually yeah. talked with Audrey Claire Farley a few weeks ago, and this concept of positive eugenics and being a particular white, quote unquote, Christian value that goes way back, mm-hmm. You know, talk about like the Quiverful movement and all this kind of Dobson sort of material. Right. I mean, it's once you, I think, start to see those connections, it becomes really obvious that like you said, our terminology may have changed over the years, and it might be just a little bit harder to see these attitudes for what they are, maybe because the words aren't as outrageous anymore.
Right. Who's to say that, like, historians 100 years from now aren't going to look back and say, like, actually your terms are just as outrageous, yeah. right? Yeah. Like, developing world, like, you know, these are, I argue that these words come straight out of the idea of the heathen world. Like, anyway.
Yeah, you'll be the vanguard 100 years from now.
No,
see, I told you that. It'd be like your dying words. So obviously that's a little bit of the issues, the problems. You talk a little bit about kind of proposed solutions throughout the years too, and just how to think this through, particularly in the Black experience. You talk a bit about W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, just kind of the varying approaches to kind of understanding how these terms work and how to combat them. So talk a little bit about the divide between those approaches. How they played out then, how they're still kind of a play now.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm really interested in pushback against the concept of the heathen by people who have been historically heathenized. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like you said, there are a range of approaches, right? So one approach might be said to be like an approach from within. So this is from mm-hmm. people who have converted to Christianity, but who see the hypocrisy in white Christian approaches towards the so-called heathen. And so I talk about what I call the heathen barometer, that like heathenness becomes a kind of measuring stick, if you will. It's like another metaphor, but a measuring stick for holding white Christians up to their own professed ideals. And so, by the mid 19th century, the concept of the heathen becomes pretty clearly attached to like people out there, to people who are not us. And so to say like you white Christians are actually behaving like Christians is a really you white Christians are actually behaving like heathens.
Sometimes that's an insult if you think about it too hard, but yeah.
right. It's actually a really effective rhetorical strategy, right? Mm-hmm. To kind of turn the tables and say, you're doing exactly what you're claiming to be missionizing people against, right? And so like Frederick Douglass, for instance.
Yeah, I was going to remind you of that 4th right. of July speech.
Yeah. And then he also says like in the appendix to the narrative, you know, how can you claim to be going out, like putting all of this money into saving the so-called heathen overseas when you're overlooking people here in America and serving the idol of King Cotton? And I think that like the term there, the idol of King Cotton, is mm-hmm. really important, because idolatry is again like seen as one of these key components of what it means to be heathen, is that you worship idols instead of the true God. So that is, I argue, like a use of the heathen barometer to say, you know, white Christians, you're total hypocrites. Mm-hmm. But then another approach comes from people who do not identify as Christians, right? Have not converted to Christianity or have unconverted mm-hmm. from Christianity. And so here, like one of the people that I talk about in the book is Wang Qinfu, who was a Chinese immigrant in the late 19th century. He was missionized, he became a Christian, and then he rejected it and then traveled around the US as like a self-proclaimed Confucian missionary mm-hmm. And became famous for his speeches against Christianity, you know, saying basically, I am a heathen, I'm proud of it, here's why I am a heathen. Those speeches are fascinating. You know, he basically says, in some ways it's a similar rhetorical strategy to like calling out the hypocrisy of Christians, sure. Except from a different kind of standpoint, right? So like they're doing exactly what they critique the heathens for doing. And then he makes the claim that heathenism, Confucianism, like that is a more ancient religion than Christianity. And that ancient religion has enabled China to become like thriving civilization that has lasted for thousands and thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, look at you Americans, like you are just you know, 100 years old at this point. And, and so, you know, who are you to tell me to convert to your ways? So yeah, that's, you know, that's a couple different strategies. And I also think it's really interesting how, so the concept of the heathen world, like we talked about earlier, is like this broad brushstrokes, like umbrella that's used to sweep people together. There's a lot of problems with that, but there's also the potential, like an interesting potential for solidarity there, right? It's like, okay, you're going to sweep us all together into this classification as like so-called heathens. Well, let's, you know, let's build on that kind of solidarity. Like, what does it mean to be put together in the same grouping with other people because we're considered to be like different from white Christians? You know, what can we do with that kind of similarity? How can we build on that?
Yeah. Great. Yeah. I mean, I kind of telegraphed it earlier, but I wanted to talk about Fanon a little bit. But I think you kind of did. I mean, I don't know that we can even go back to it after what you just said, because yeah, there's this, I think this juxtaposition of part of what he does in Russia to the Earth, and what you mentioned is that he's saying that not that the project of colonization is not only effective for the colonizers, but it effectively brings on this kind of like what Cornel West would call like the black bourgeoisie of like the colonized that are now like this kind of small subsection that are benefiting. But yeah, I think what you're saying is kind of the flip side of that coin, is that that there's been this long trail of folks that have pushed back on that, you know, with their whole lives. So yeah, I mean, I think that's always encouraging to hear about folks that had it right in a very difficult, confusing time. I mean, sure.
It's still difficult and confusing.
Yeah.
like I say in the book that like I'm like my own primary source. I started off talking about my own background on this, and I'm a historian because I don't have it figured out. Like I'm trying to understand the history of how people have dealt with these kinds of ideas over time and how they've responded. But I'm not an ethicist, right? Like I'm not a theologian. Mm-hmm. So I don't have like prognostications of like, what should we do?
Yeah. Right.
I'm hoping that theologians and ethicists might read this. Yeah, give me some ideas.
Yeah, totally. I mean, shoot. Hopefully someone that has the answers can know. But yeah, I mean, to also now do one more turn to the fact that, I mean, the verbiage may have changed a little bit, but this otherizing and heathenizing is alive and well. And you have a really great article that just came out a few days ago in Religion News Service. And it's called War in Civilized Europe is Nothing New. Here's Why White Westerners Think Otherwise. So in the opinion piece, you're talking about there's a several news clips, and I'm sure there's a mashup somewhere. Maybe I'll find and put in the show notes. But of reporters, I mean, it's white reporters, pretty much all talking about Russia and Ukraine and having this shock that this is happening in a European non-third world, going back to those terms that we don't bat an eye at usually, but are indicating the exact same thing as these older terms. But I mean, I think, yeah, talk about what you did in that article, kind of what your first reactions were before you put pen to paper, because I think a lot of us kind of rolled our eyes at what people that are pretending to be very smart on TV are saying, you know, one of them, we were talking before we started recording, but one of them said, oh, I probably shouldn't be saying this out loud. And then he went ahead and said that.
Said it out loud. Yeah.
Yeah. That this is typical in like Palestine and Israel and stuff, but not like for, not for advanced societies. And it's like, yeah, no, you shouldn't think that, but definitely don't say that.
So, yeah. But like people have been saying that. So actually, you know, like it's now the age of social media. And so this is all over social media and people have been like tweeting it and sending it to me. Like, what do you make of this? So I thought, okay, I just have to write something about this because yeah, it is just like the more things change, the more they stay the same, right? Like that's kind of how I end the book, which is a bit depressing, but yeah, this, you know, this kind of language, I think traces exactly back to what I'm trying to show in the book, which is that there's an idea that there is a quote unquote heathen world out there full of unfortunates who Europeans and Euro-Americans are supposed to be helping and saving. And that's part of what makes European, Euro-American, like white Christian identity is this notion that we are the helpers, we are the saviors, the white saviors, right? And so anything that kind of challenges that identity is a source of huge anxiety. So you were talking earlier about like this sense of fear. If you look at conservatives' writings, I mean, this sense of fear is, that's also like, there's a long history to that sense of fear. Like this anxiety is ever present, right? The identity of being a white Christian savior is a tentative one. It's a tenuous one. And I think what we're seeing here is a challenge to that kind of identity, right? If there's like this conflict at the heart of Europe, like what does that mean about Europeans? And that's why you get these reporters, not just reporters either, but like Prince William saying stuff like, you know, this is alien, quote unquote alien, to see, because Europeans are supposed to be the ones helping the heathen world or the third world or the developing countries. They don't know better. Like that's the implication, right? They don't know better. They fight all the time. We're supposed to be the ones helping them, not the ones where this is happening, like on our shores. And there's been like different kinds of reactions to this, right? So like one, I mean, a lot of people have called out this media coverage because it's just,
like, it's really, you
know,
bad.
It's bad. but yeah, you know, one way to try to like approach this kind of anxiety is an attempt to preserve the Europe as pure and different narrative by orientalizing Russia. Mm. You can see that kind of narrative playing out in the media also. You know, I'm not like trying to claim that what's happening is, it's a terrible situation all around, but you know, the coverage of it, like obviously there are problems with the coverage of it. Right. So one way to do this is to like basically depict Russia as an orientalized aggressor against a European nation. But of course, then you also have like, people on the far right who look to Russia as also like a kind of exemplar, upholding certain kinds of Christian values. So it's like, it's super complicated, obviously.
It's also hilarious. I think the naivete of, just the ignorance, it's probably not hilarious is the wrong word, but I don't know, terrifying. The ignorance of, or the out of touchness, I guess, of a Prince William or of a press figure that, again, is pretending to say something intelligent and is apparently completely unaware of the West's history of imperialism.
Right.
Of American, like, we have been messing around with brown people for a long time in America. Like, that's like official U.S. foreign policy. And we've been doing it to some whitish people out there. I mean, it's like, it's
right. Yeah.
To everyone. Yeah.
There's deep history.
Yes. Yes. It's
like foundational to American identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think also just the simplification or the oversimplification again, and this is another parallel to even the word heathen and to this us and them, kind of Manichaeanism that has to just see things as that black or white. this sort of conflict can't be happening among two people that look like us. This is right. This one of them has to be messed up, or this is so shocking that I have no category for
right.
white people going to war with white people.
Yeah.
It's the first time.
Oh gosh.
Okay. One last question I had for you, and then I want you to give a couple of plugs for this book coming out, and then for maybe some other writings, other work that you've got going on. But, and I'm not sure if I'm going to come up with a question for this. So I'm going to start talking and you can just interject when I'm done with whatever ramble or just tell me to move on. But I'm super curious about the connections, and you already mentioned it, between your earlier work on hell and the heathen word and substance and dialogue. And I'm particularly asking this, cards on the table, because I grew up very evangelical as well. One of my professors in college has written several books on, particularly on Jonathan Edwards and his view on hell, on many other, he's written many well-regarded books on that. Who's an influential professor of mine in undergrad. I went to an evangelical divinity school. So I've definitely inherited this view and taken this on.
Right.
And it's only been in recent years that I kind of think back and like, huh, I don't know about all that. That's a lot of fraught belief. So, yeah, if there's a connection there that I said that's not directly related to something I need to work out with a therapist or a spiritual advisor or whatever. I guess the functionality of hell and making this an otherizing dynamic throughout history.
Oh yeah. Fraught is a good word. The functionality of hell. That's so interesting. Like the word function there, because hell does exactly, it plays a function in spurring people to action, right? Like I think mm-hmm. that it's really powerful in that regard. And I think that that a lot of people kind of overlook, or a lot of scholars at least overlook the importance of hell as a spur to action, because it just seems like a belief that's so out there for people in the, you know, quote unquote secular academy.
Sure.
And so there's like scholarship about the decline of hell, and nobody can really believe in that. Even in the 19th century, people were saying, like, who could actually believe in this concept of hell?
Yeah.
But I try to show in the first book that like tons of people really believe in
yes, that's, hell. Yeah, that's not an yeah, that didn't seem ever weird to me until again, like
right.
several years ago. I knew that people right. didn't believe in hell, but like
but yeah. they were going to hell.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I mean, so that's actually one of the really interesting things that came out of the research for my first book, is that in the 19th century, I think the belief in hell was, a lot of people believed that they themselves could actually go there. Like they were genuinely worried about hell sure. somewhere that they might end up. And I think that that also connects to the death rates in the 19th century. Like there's the medicines are not what they are today. Like medical interventions are not what they are today. You could actually die from like getting a cold, and, you know, it turns into mm-hmm. some infection or like whatever, like an accident, yeah. you could die. Children were warned that they were going to die and go to hell.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real shift that happens there. I think that the shift happens for a number of reasons over the course of the 19th century. I think the Civil War is a major turning point. Mm-hmm. The scale of death is just so high that ministers can't be there at the deathbeds of soldiers who, you know, and they can't be there to see if they had a good death or not. And so they're not going to want to like write back to their family saying, I think that your loved one might actually be in hell.
Yeah.
So there's a shift that happens where people sort of aren't as worried about going to hell for themselves by the late 19th into the 20th centuries, but maintain a belief in hell for others. Right? And I think that that persists to this day. I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't people who still believe that they themselves might go to hell, but I don't think it's as, I don't think it's as prominent as it was in the 19th century.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. I'll have to take that to someone and make work some of that out personally, but I wanted,
yeah.
wanted to get a scholarly look at it anyways, before I do that. well, great. Tell us again where we can get the book. I'll link to it in the show notes, but and then what you've got coming that you're working on that we can look for.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so the book is available for pre-order at Harvard's. It's coming out with Harvard University Press. It's available on their website for pre-order, I think, from any bookseller. If they don't have it, you could ask for it. That'd be great. Thanks. Coming out in mid-May. And what is next? So I'm kind of just toying with some ideas right now, but I think I actually want to write a more like kind of micro history. So my first two books were pretty like big about these big concepts over a long period of time. And I want to do something that's more focused on individuals. So I want to write a micro history of, I think, Wang Qianfu, who's that Chinese immigrant that I mentioned earlier, the one who is the self-styled like Confucian missionary to the US. And just kind of think through these questions of, what does it mean to convert? So he converts to Christianity, why does he unconvert? What are the different pressures in his life? Like, what is religious life like in the United States in the era of Chinese exclusion? He's really, really interesting figure. There's like tons of newspaper articles written about him at the time. That's the idea. Something about religion under Chinese exclusion and maybe focusing on him.
Yeah. That's awesome. I hope you write that.
Thanks.
I want to talk to you about it when you do. Well,
like 15 years from now.
Yeah, exactly. That's I'm sure that's quite an undertaking, but maybe we'll stay in touch. Let's stay in touch.
That'd be great.
Okay, Dr. Catherine Jin Lum, thank you so much for joining today. And we'll keep up and hope to have you back on soon.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's the show for this week. Thanks again to Dr. Catherine Jin Lum for joining. Thanks to Phil Nellis for the art for this show and for Orbach for providing the music. Now go in peace to love and serve.